today for the very reasons that I stated earlier to discuss this issue. Now, I haven't had adequate time to look at your amendment. I would certainly be willing to discuss that, but again, I would point out that it was not adequately handled in Southern Oregon. And the reason we have a letter from the Jackson County Commissioners is because the Jackson County Commissioners had no jurisdiction over this line, and they were quite bothered by that fact.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. Gary Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gary Bauer, representing Portland General Electric. I will try and make this brief. I think you've heard lots of background. Briefly, Portland General Electric has over 700 miles of transmission lines on its system. These are connect both our generation facilities and our various substations to serve our customers. We are concerned with a couple of things in the proposal. One is the lowering of the threshold down to 230 kVs. This type of system is what we use to provide power to our various substations and interconnect our entire system.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
That's been mentioned quite a few times, Gary. 230 is standard, and then 231 would be in excess of, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The other concern that we have is the use of the word modification or modify. Our engineers believe that that's what they're doing on a daily basis, is working on our system, making modifications, upgrading the system, and improving its efficiency. Another concern we have is in the review that's being proposed by the Citizens Committee is one of operating. To our folks' view, operating is would include the hour-to-hour scheduling of power on the system. And that may sound nitpicking, but those are how our folks read those types of words. We'd be happy to work with Representative Peterson and others to try and address her problem. I'm very aware of the problem. I've attended some of the meetings in Southern Oregon on the California Oregon Transmission Line Project and recognize that it has been a problem for people in Southern Oregon.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Gary, have you reviewed, I guess you call it, the PPO proposal just to by inserting the word 10 miles in total and striking in the state. And I guess the essence of that is to bring anything of major new construction under the FSEC.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I've just read their draft amendments once right before this hearing. I believe you're correct that it would bring into account large systems, large alterations, which is was the original intent of the Siting Council legislation.
Anyone else? Thank you, Gary. I think that's all the testimony on this bill, 3168. I think.
Mr. Chair, there's one other individual from Southern Oregon who just arrived who'd like to make a real brief statement,
fine.
I believe.
Thank you.
My name's Dave Willis. I've lived up on the Green Springs area for 7 or 8 years. Before I arrived, there was a power line built in our area by PP&L. At one of the hearings about this power line, the public relations man from PP&L was reminded that we were told by PP&L that we wouldn't see any more power lines in our area in the future, that the one in the late 70s would be the last one. And he smiled. That was his answer. Seems like I'm always on the other side of the issue from big corporations in issues that I get involved with. Usually it seems it's the timber industry. But when the power line issue came up, I called some friends of mine that have some experience in environmental issues beyond timber. And they said, Oh, way to go, Dave. You're really into it now. The only thing that swings more weight in Oregon besides timber is energy.
And they didn't mean the energy department, did they?
No, they didn't.
Go ahead.
You've heard all the details. What I want to say to you today is, because we are an unincorporated community, we need the protection of state regulations. And we need to be rescued. The public interest of rural Oregon and Oregon's rural citizens needs to be protected from big-time private interest that sees rural neighborhoods as merely blank space on their corporate playing fields. This is not just rhetoric. I support HB 3168, and I hope that you will too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Lieutenant Gilman.
I have to ask one. Do you feel that really we shouldn't build any more power lines at all in Oregon?
I think that we better ask some serious questions about what we have in Oregon. And if there's water going over the spillway, whether that water can be regarded as merely surplus power. Whether the purpose of our rivers is merely as an electricity factory for Southern California or whoever will pay the highest dollar for it. I'm extremely concerned that we see our state as merely a commodity. And I think that our regulations in the state need to recognize it as more than a commodity.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. At this point, let me close the hearing on 3168. And let me ask Representative Peterson, I think probably the thing to do at this point would be to have you meet with the various parties and see if we can't come up with some resolution of the issue. Mm-hmm. Fine. We will hold the hearing off then until we hear from the parties. At this point, my administrator says she needs a few minutes to pull together some material on House Bill 2145. Why don't we be in recess for about 2 minutes? Hearing on 2145. And I'll ask, also mentioned before we call on witnesses for the committee, those that are here, you have three proposed amendments on this bill in your folder. The first of these, hand-grossed, you can put aside. The second one is the current PUC proposed amendments, number two. And number three are proposed amendments also engrossed by the Northwest Natural Gas Company. At this point, I will ask Roy Hemingway from Boise Cascade to come forward. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roy Hemingway. I'm appearing on behalf of Boise Cascade Corporation. We appear this afternoon in support of the staff amendments, PUC staff amendments to House Bill 2145. You'll recall that 2145 would allow the Public Utility Commissioner and the subsequent commission to use deferred accounting, or in layman's terms, retroactive rate making, as a rate making tool. That is to allow costs to accrue in accounts of the utility and to be later incorporated into rates. That isn't solely a question of costs. It sometimes can actually be a question of revenues which would be returned to ratepayers. As you have heard, deferred accounting is a practice generally discouraged by utility rate makers, but we believe that it can well be a useful tool in rate making. And though Boise Cascade is appearing here as a consumer of utility services, we do not appear here as totally opposed to the concept of retroactive rate making and deferred accounting in all circumstances. Boise Cascade's concern about this legislation derives from the situation that Boise is facing in eastern Oregon with its mills in the service territory of CP National Corporation. That corporation was allowed by Commissioner Maudlin to accumulate costs from deferred cogeneration purchases in a deferred account beginning last February of 1986. Those costs accrued in that account through November of 1986 when Commissioner Maudlin, in one of his last acts, allowed those costs to be put into rates. In addition, at the same time, he added those past costs. He added those past costs on top of a rate increase, which resulted in some close to a 20% rate increase to Boise Cascade. The deferred amounts alone amounted to some 8% rate increase to Boise Cascade. These amounts in the deferred account were ones that were forecastable, were ones that the utility could have seen were coming down the road, but they chose for reasons of their own not to file our timely rate case, instead to accumulate those amounts in a deferred account. We are discussing the legitimacy of those amounts in the current rate case in front of the PUC, and we hope to have some relief from those amounts soon. We support a limitation on deferred accounting, and the staff amendment we think is an appropriate limitation. It would say that deferred accounting is permissible, but when those deferred accounts get so large that they ought to be amortized in rates, they should be amortized such that the rate impact is relatively small from the deferred accounting. The staff amendment is for a maximum 3% rate impact from amortization of a deferred account, and we think that's an appropriate amount. The experience that Boise Cascade has had trying to live with an 8% impact on top of an additional rate increase of about 12% has shown that that great rate shock can occur if deferred accounting is allowed to get out of control, as it did in CP National's case. A 3% rate increase as a result of deferred accounting, we think, would bring that problem back into control without forcing the PUC and the utilities to give up what can be a useful regulatory tool.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Mr. Hemingway, the deferred amount, the 8%, is that's a temporary measure? Did they do that over a 12-month period?
They did it for a 12-month period.
It could vary?
It could vary. It would be up to the commissioner as to determine how much how long a period that amortization should occur. If the 3% maximum were put into place under the staff amendment, and say the amount in the deferred account had built to 6% of revenues, then it would take 2 years for that deferred account to be worked off.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vikas.
One of the things that bothers me about this is that I'm not sure we have a very clear definition of unpub, except when we have some decisions imposed upon us by another agency of the federal government, that we don't necessarily have very clear criteria as to under what conditions a deferred account ought to be allowed. In this case, you indicated that these costs could have been forecast and probably should have been or could have been known ahead of time, except maybe for the 7 cents. I'm not sure of the sequence there, but what ought to be the sort of criteria that would guide the Public Utility Commission in making a decision as to whether or not something ought to be deferred or not?
Representative Ekus, I think clearly whether it is an extraordinary expense is one. whether it is one that's likely to get to be a temporary charge only, such as the gas company often gets a either a refund or a small increase in their pipeline charges. There is every reason, every regulatory reason to believe that, in my opinion, that those amounts should be flowed through to ratepayers, whether they're refunds or charges. They're costs that the gas company cannot control. The fact that they are relatively small, that they cannot be effectively forecasted, and the fact that they vary quickly over time, I think are good criteria that the commission could use.
Mr. Chairman, when you say extraordinary, you're not talking about size.
No, I'm talking about out of the ordinary. For instance, my understanding is Northwest Natural Gas has a program to track down leaks in the Portland area. This is a one-time program. That kind of thing is probably an appropriate one for this kind of treatment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Roy, in this instance, was most of this a PURPA mandate type thing that caused the extra costs?
The Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act mandated that the utility buy this power. We are contesting in the rate case the amount that CP National needed to pay for that power. But the purchases themselves were PURPA mandated, yes.
Then other examples might be Department of Environmental Quality, orders for whatever, scrubbers, those type of things would also fall under this bill?
That's my understanding. Things like franchise fees, taxes from localities would fall under.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Representative Commissioner Davis is set. Chairman, again, I'm Bill Warren, Assistant Commissioner with the Public Utility Commissioner. To my right is Ray Lambeth, and my far right is Dr. Philosophy, our Chief Counsel. Before we get into questions regarding the current status of the bill, the Administrator is handing out a letter that I've transmitted to the Chairman today that answers some of the questions from our last session on the 25th of March. Let me just walk you through this material very briefly, and we'll be glad to answer questions if you wish. Firstly, there's a cover letter that is fairly self-explanatory, and I'll go into that in a little more detail in a moment. The first attachment to the cover letter is a glossary of terms I believe Representative Parkinson asked for. It deals with the significant terminology used in the context of this proposed legislation. That starts at after the letter, at the first 5 pages. It's a memorandum from Mr. Lambert and myself. The second piece of information after that memorandum is a memorandum from Mr. Girard and myself covering the chronology of the recently concluded Pacific Power and Light rate case, UE52. I believe Representative Ekus asked for this information. What we tried to do in an attachment to that memorandum is show graphically how the PP&L rate case transpired, and that is attached to Mr. Girard's memo. Following that memo is a 5-page document that has been previously transmitted to you, containing a list of the deferred accounts covered and those not covered by the recent Attorney General's opinion of March 18, 1987. Significant change in the information on this list, as previously transmitted to you, is a footnote C, which illustrates for the committee
which accounts were established within the context of a general rate proceeding under ORS 757-210. I believe that particular issue was raised by Northwest Natural in one of its amendments. And lastly, the last two documents are summaries of staff issue papers in the Portland General Electric rate case, which is currently ongoing, and the recently concluded Civic Power and Light rate case, which was concluded in January. I think it will give you an idea of the types of issues we address in rate case. Returning to the transmittal letter for a moment, please, on page 2, cover briefly with you a discussion I had with Commissioner Davis. He supports Northwest Natural's amendment to the bill, bill's provision section 22C, which would allow FERC accounting activities related to revenue items as well as expense items. We find that to be a reasonable amendment to support it. The remainder of the first full paragraph on page 2 expresses our commissioner's opinion as to why the other two amendments offered by Northwest Natural would not be appropriate. And lastly, we do feel, and the commissioner has expressed agreement, that Mr. Meek did raise a valid point with regards to section 2.2 on March 25th. We would support wording consistent with a policy wherein any party could propose deferred accounting activities to the commissioner or the commission, effective Wednesday, a commission, rather than just utility. I think that's a fair standard.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Ekus.
Bill, thank you for providing all this information. I wonder, though, if you could take me to the chronology. Where is that?
That's Mr. Gerard's memo, Representative Ekus, of March 27th. It's about page 8 or 9 of the attachment.
Let's see here.
It's this document, too. So.
Right after chronology. I mean, right after the definitions.
Oh, okay.
It's easiest, perhaps, to look at the attached chart or graph. Leisure and example.
I don't know whether it's easier. Only if you see staff
can say that. Let me introduce you to the graph from Vendigas by saying what transpired in the PP&L case was as follows. Back in June 23rd, you look on the horizontal axis. The commissioner allowed deferred accounting for the Colstrip 4 generating plant that was placed into service on April 1st. On October 23rd, he allowed similar deferred accounting for the Jim Bridger scrubber unit, which was placed in service on October 1st. Now, if you look at the light shaded area, that is designed to represent the deferrals allowed by the commissioner to accumulate by the utility, which were subsequently written off effective January 8, 1987, as a temporary surcharge in rates represented by the, we'll call it a slashed area, from 5 to 6 up above there. Now that temporary increment expires in January 1988, and rates will be reduced, holding all else equal, in January 1988 for that effect. And let me just conclude, please, okay, by saying that the reason that was done, I think I've said this previously, is to not have several rate boosts during 1986, but to have it all occur at one time, and it did on January 8, 1987.
When was the order for, the rate increase?
The actual change in billing occurred. The customers did not see any rate change until January 8, 1987.
Okay.
No billing changes at all until that date.
And when, prior to that, when was the last rate order on PP&L?
The the last rate change preceding that was July 1985. Is that correct, Mr. Miller?
Yeah.
July 1985 was the BPA rate change that caused that to occur.
So from July 85 to January 8th, 1987, there was no rate change?
That's correct.
BP&L.
That is correct.
I see some different nodding back there, but okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
Along the same line, what the between 5 and 6, the temporary increase to cover the retro, what percent of the increase was that? I guess it's did it exceed
3%?
No, it's
5, sir. 1.3.
1.3, thank you.
Is that it?
Mr. Warren, I take it then that the proposed amendments, LC 2145-2, earlier put forward by PUC, is still current. Is that correct?
With
the indication that you would accept one or two changes with Northwest Gas?
Mr. Chair, we would accept the proposed amendment to section 22C by Northwest Natural Gas, which reads as follows. Instead of amounts incurred by a utility, it would read utility or expenses or revenues, the recovery of which.
Fine.
We don't support the other proposals by Northwest Natural. We would support the change I referred to lastly in my letter, wherein any party could introduce a proposal before the commission.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ickes.
Bill, I'm going to go back to our chart again here a moment. On 5, the order 87-034 that authorized a 4% rate increase, was that a full rate proceedings?
Yes, sir.
Looked at forecasts and cost of capital and everything else.
That's summarized with the last attachment to the package of materials, all the issues that were looked at, a brief summary of what those issues were.
That's on the last three pages?
Yes,
pages?
Four pages.
Four pages, all right.
Let me again remind the committee in your amendments in your packet. Number one, you can discard. Number two is those amendments proposed by the PUC. Number three, by Northwest Natural Gas, and as indicated, there are a couple of those items that PUC said would be acceptable to them. Representative Ickes has indicated that he will be the point man for getting this issue resolved. And unless I have other questions, I will close the hearing.
Mr. Chair, I requested it. You indicated.
Oh, all right. Whatever. He's going to do it anyway. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I'll close the hearing then on 2145. And at this point, we will open the hearing on House Bill 2144. Well, we started like we had a couple people last Wednesday. You remember we had people out of town, there were a couple, so we didn't get very far on it.
It's getting that bad, huh?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
I would at this point call Richard Byrd, Oregon Steel Mills. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Richard Byrd. With me is our attorney, Mike Dotton, our Kellerman White McCullough. I'm manager of the Environment and Energy for Oregon Steel Mills in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2144.
Oregon Steel Mills operates a carbon steel plate mini mill in Portland and employs 465 people. It has an employee stock ownership plan, so its employees are literally its owners. Due to surplus worldwide capacity in steel plate and documented unfair trade practices for foreign competitors, Oregon Steel has experienced net operating losses for the last 4 years. Nevertheless, largely because of special contracts that it has been able to secure with Portland General Electric and Northwest Natural Gas, and the sacrifices and cooperation of its workforce, Oregon Steel Mills has been able to continue in business. As you have undoubtedly read, the steel business, including the steel plate manufacturing segment of that business, is intensely competitive. To compete today, a steel mill has no alternative but to cut its production costs. Increases in production costs cannot be passed to its customers. Indeed, despite the significant inflation in virtually every cost element of production, steel prices have actually declined from their 1981 level of $471 per ton to $381 per ton today. Our domestic and